Welcome to the OA Light a Candle Meeting Podcast. Visit our website at www.oalaig.org, where you'll find 3 separate speaker feeds with over 200 speaker files, forms for ordering CDs for these speakers, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Michael.
My name is Michael. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Michael.
And Leslie, thank you for asking me to come here this evening. It's good to see some people that I know. It's good to see somebody that is new that I haven't seen for like 20 years. And what a coincidence. Welcome. I came to you in the 80s when I first got sober. I got sober originally in 1982 through Alcoholics Anonymous. And after my first year sober, I was smoking 3 packs a day. And I couldn't stop. I started bitching and complaining about it in AA meetings, and the old-timers told me to bitch and complain somewhere else. And according to the traditions, all we have to worry about is drinking in this program, and I was very offended. So somebody told me that there was a Smokers Anonymous in those days. I think it's still around. It's called Nicotine Anonymous now. And he said, why don't you bitch and complain in Smokers Anonymous? So I said, okay, I went. And there was one guy there, and he talked for an hour about what he was like, what happened, and what he was like without the cigarettes, and he said, see you next week. And I came back next week. In about 6 weeks, the 3-pack-a-day addiction was removed, and it was amazing. And shortly after, he nominated me secretary and left, and I would show up many times with just a big book, you know, and sit for an hour, and nobody would show up. But the problem was, is I put on 30 pounds in 30 days. And it was not the first time I had gained a lot of weight. It was the first time I was conscious of gaining a lot of weight. And so I went back to AA, and I bitched and complained about Haagen-Dazs and pizza and eggnog shakes and taquitos and Tito's tacos and all that good stuff. And those same old-timers told me to shut up again. You know, I'm a slow learner. And so I came to Overeaters Anonymous, and I sat and I listened and I isolated. And I heard a lot of people didn't eat sugar, and some people didn't eat bread and white flour, and I thought I could do it, but I couldn't, and I just kept getting heavier and heavier and heavier. And finally I reached out, retrospect, I guess it took me a year, I reached out, I said, my name is Michael, I'm a compulsive overeater, and I need help, I don't know how to do this. And that M, who was lost well over 100 pounds, reached back to me and told me to call him. And I called him, and he asked me what I had eaten the day before, and I had no idea. And he asked me what I was going to eat this day, and I had no idea, nor did I want to have any idea. And he very kindly said, well, why don't you just call me, you know, tomorrow and let me know the exact nature of your food. Just, like, write it down and let me know what you ate. And that was the beginning of my journey. And it was hard to do, and it's a lot easier today, but that was the beginning of my journey. The weight came off fairly easily, and I started getting active in this program. What had happened was I thought I had outside issues. I was born to a mom who suffered from postpartum depression. And that's fairly common, I think, amongst ladies. But hers developed into postpartum psychosis, and she was diagnosed as a schizophrenic in the early 50s. And she had to be hospitalized. She was suicidal, and she didn't have a happy life. In the old days, they had an operation called a lobotomy, where they cut the brain that they thought was diseased, and she was one of the first people to get one. She was really, really in a lot of pain, and it didn't make her any worse, but it didn't make her any better. So anyway, and then, you know, my father died of cirrhosis of the liver, and his father died of cirrhosis. So the disease sort of runs rampant in my family. And I thought, when I didn't want to get up in the morning and go to work, that I might have a chemical imbalance going on. And you people told me that perhaps I was lazy, or, you know, and, you know, just go, you know, get up and, you know, work an honest day's pay for an honest day. So I was stuck in my job, and I was bored, and I was afraid to go out and look for another job. And what had happened is I started to go to psychiatrists. and I got into group therapy, and I pulled away from you guys, and I wasn't calling my sponsor, and I was learning about my inner child, and I was actually carrying teddy bears to OA meetings. I was single at the time, and women actually liked that. But it wasn't enough to keep me coming back to OA because I couldn't do both programs. I had a problem because in psychiatry, it seemed like I was supposed to be introspective and feel my feelings and analyze them. And in this program, I'm supposed to be outward and help you and shake hands with the newcomer and act better than I feel. And I couldn't equate the two. I couldn't do it. So I dropped you guys. And what I was looking was for an easier, softer way. And after a few years in psychotherapy, I finally found one. And I ended up on antidepressants and seeing three psychiatrists and being in AA we call it alcoholic behavior. I don't know what you call it in Overeaters Anonymous, compulsive overeating behavior. The ism was there, the craziness was there. And I heard Dr. Paul in this facility. Dr. Paul wrote the story, Doctor, Addict, Alcoholic. I think it's called On Acceptance Now. And I always identified with that story. And he stood at the podium and he said, never in my 20-some-odd years of sobriety have I had a problem to which the 12 steps did not offer me a solution. And I was so far away from the 12 steps at that time, and I was so confused that you know how something resonates when you hear from the podium, and I knew that he was right. And he also asked how many people were on the medication that I was on, and nobody raised their hand. And more important than that, I didn't raise my hand. And for some reason, I was too afraid to talk to him, but I asked his wife, Max, who was sitting in the front row, for his phone number. And to make a long story short, I called him and asked for help like I did Matt. And he said, why don't you come back to the program that has saved your life? And he took me under his wing, and we started to work the steps again. And I quit all my psychiatrists. I quit because I trusted him. He was a doctor. I quit my antidepressants and stuff. And I was new all over again. And it's easy for me to be new in OA because I'm an alcoholic, so I don't drink. So, and I don't use. And I was using all kinds of pills alcoholically. So when I started over in AA, I started over in OA as well. That was my absence date is July 20th, 1990. And, I was looking to take a fifth step with somebody. And, at that time, Dr. Paul had fired me because I called him one day and I did some behavior that I was ashamed of. And he said in sobriety, we do stuff that makes us feel good. And he says, part of you wants to recover and part of you doesn't. I'm going to leave you alone with yourself. Don't call me for a while. And I was devastated. And I didn't know what to do. And then Richie showed up in my life. And Richie said, I read my inventory to a sponsor. It took me 3 days. He said, I'll listen to your inventory. So, and sure enough, 3 days. Took us 3 days. Not 3 days. So, of course we had to break to eat. We're compulsive overeaters. But, it took 3 days, and then by the third day, we were both sort of nauseous because it was the same stuff over different people, same character defects and stuff. And so he got me into calling in my food again before I ate it. And I call it taking a fifth step with my food, admitting to God, to myself and another human being, the exact nature of my food. And I do that to this day. Now, Richie went and got married, and he deserted me. And he moved to North Carolina, and I tried to cling on to him as much as I could, but he said, why don't you get a sponsor that you could see eyeball to eyeball? And I said, yeah, but Richie, this works. My AA sponsors people all over the world. It's going to work. And he let me cling on for a while. He says, you got to get yourself a local sponsor. So I got myself a local sponsor. It wasn't easy, and, you know, the trust issue and all that stuff we have to go through again when we find somebody new. But I finally got somebody and got comfortable with him and still have him today. I like sharing here because my what it's like now has changed significantly, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit. In the summer, I went to the doctor, and he told me I had borderline high cholesterol. It was pretty high, actually. And, of course, the first thing I want to do is take a pill so that I can eat all the red meat I can possibly eat, and the cholesterol will go down. And he was more than willing to give me the pill. Years ago, I had high blood pressure as well. And while I was with you guys, I thought I was eating really healthy. I mean, I was at a pretty good weight and everything. And I told the doctor, let me do diet and exercise first before I take the pill. Well, years went by, and I wasn't dieting, and I was doing it in moderation, but I wasn't really doing it that much, and so I finally succumbed to taking the pill for the blood pressure, because I wasn't willing to do anything about it. When I heard about the cholesterol, I called Richie and in North Carolina. And I told him, you know, all this stuff. And he says, you know, and he said, diet and exercise is my solution to the problem. And he didn't necessarily mean like the diet as we know it. You know, he calls it a live it. You know, you do the healthy food choices a day at a time. And he told me what he was doing. And he was very, very accountable on a daily basis to what he was eating. And I don't know about you, but my eating habits, I was taking a fifth step with my food, but my fifth step would consist of, well, you know, McDonald's is at the corner, I'm eating a third Angus and a large fry. And I'd do that a couple of times a week. And I thought if I went into In-N-Out Burger and got it protein style, you know, where they take the buns off and you get the double-double and the cheese and stuff, it's delicious. And it's healthy because there's salad in between. So I wasn't really looking at what I was doing too closely. I was committing it to my sponsor. And my sponsor, you know, is on, he eats differently than I do, at least for the past few months. So I started committing my food to Richie, and he started to tell me about turkey instead of hamburgers. And, you know, a portion of a steak is like a fist or something like that if you don't want to weigh and measure. And, you know, I have to eat the whole thing. In restaurants, they give you like three portions at least, you know. And so I'm accountable. And my cholesterol was 250 in August. And last week I went and it's 150. So diet and exercise has done the trick so far. And I wasn't really trying to lose weight, but I've taken off like 23 pounds. And I don't necessarily, you know, want to get anorexic with this thing. And when I get kind of crazy with my weight, you know, Richie says it's not about the weight, it's about you take care of the healthy food choices and the weight takes care of itself. So I'm glad. I guess I go to any lengths to get Richie back into my life because I'm calling him, you know, pretty much on a daily basis and taking the fifth step with him. And I'm hanging real close to you and my sponsor in this program for the spiritual aspects of it. Because if I don't have the spiritual aspects of the program, I'll quit making healthy food choices. And for today, I feel pretty comfortable. And it's the exercise, too. I hear Richie's voice 4 to 7 times a week, 4 to 7 times a week. You know, and I was for years was striving for 3 times a week, and more than average, I do maybe 2, 1 a week. So now, the last couple of months, maybe 2 or 3 months, I'm doing 4 to 7 times a week, and it feels good. And I'm not obsessed about it. I have a stopwatch here, and it's set up for a half an hour. And for every minute the thing rings, and 1 minute I'll walk fast, and the next minute I'll jog, and the next minute I'll walk, and the next minute I'll jog. And it's moderation, and I don't necessarily like to do it, but I really feel good afterwards. I like to feel good. Food made me feel good for many, many years. And it's, what is it, the endorphins? You know, it kind of relaxes me for the rest of the day. So it's that delayed gratification that I get. So that's kind of what my life is like now. And I told you the, you know, my family background. I'll tell you how the spirituality of the program has changed my life. I never had a full-time job until I was 43 years old. In the old days, I used to consider myself an actor. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you this story. When I was in City College, the first semester, I was a skinny kid. I was always uncomfortable in my body, fat or skinny. And I had like a 27, a 28-inch waist. Because they measured me, because I played a munchkin in The Wizard of Oz in my first semester. By the end of that show, I found myself, because, you know, theater people sometimes can be a little egocentric. And they can be out there and, you know, expressive. And I was, you know, but I was scared to death. So I would frequent the Foster Freeze on the corner there. And I'd have my eggnog shakes and my taquitos. They were much more comforting than, you know, hanging out with egocentric people that I was scared to death of. I'm still hanging out with them, but in Overeaters Anonymous meetings. So then at the end of that show, I had a 36 waist. And I weighed 180 pounds. So from 125 to 180, so it was kind of nice. So anyway, in those days I thought I was an actor, and I got myself this part-time job, and whenever they asked me to commit to full-time employment, I told them that I'd have to be available to go on auditions, and I had to leave at noon. And I would leave at noon, but I wouldn't go on auditions. I'd go to the beach, and I'd work on my tan, just in case any auditions happened to come my way. I was scared to death of everything. And I had enough money, you know, to live by myself, you know, and it worked. But when I got sober and abstinent this last time, my wife couldn't support me quite in the manner to which I was accustomed. And we started having children. And it was kind of time to get responsible. And my sponsor suggested that I made a mistake of telling him that I was in the middle of student teaching before I went out to practice my disease. And he said, well, why don't you go back and talk to a counselor at school? I said, I don't think I want to teach. I think I'm an actor. And he said, and he was very wise, you know. He didn't say, well, you're not an actor. If you're an actor, you act, you know. He said, you know, it doesn't matter, Mike, if you're an actor, if you're a, you know, lawyer, whatever. What matters is to go back and complete something that you left incomplete. Can you talk to a counselor? Yeah, I can talk to a counselor. So I went back. I talked to the counselor. It turns out that all the classes that I had taken 17 years prior were applicable in the present time, and I just need to go take, I think, one other class and then go student teach. And so I signed up for the class. I still didn't want to teach. And I took the class, and I got my teaching credential real, real quickly. And when I went on auditions, I did go on auditions, finally, for a responsible job. One of the classes was kids that were physically health impaired, little babies in walkers and wheelchairs, and my heart just melted. And one of the interviews I went on, there was an opening for that. And I was honest. I said, I've never taught before, but here's my resume. When I student taught this last time, the kids wrote me letters, and I showed them, we love you, Mr. Blanc, you're the best. And that was my resume. And they hired me. They hired me to teach kids that were physically health impaired. And I did that for 11 years in the same classroom. And I loved the kids. And every time I get nervous, and I don't know, Richie, with the standards and the test scores, he said, shut up and love the kids. Just go to school and love the kids. And I loved the kids. A few years ago, something came my way. They have something called the Arts Education Program with LAUSD, where you go around to different schools during the year and you teach theater arts to children. So I make a long story short, I showed up and auditioned for it and interviewed for it. And I've been doing that. It's been my fourth year of doing that. And I love the kids, kindergarten through sixth grade. And I teach them a lot of what I learn in here. And I don't know if I'm teaching them anything about theater arts, but we're having a ball, and it's just a great job. I get scared sometimes. My wife got laid off. She worked for the job for 32 years, and they outsourced her position. She's on unemployment right now. She's a little scared herself. We just got a letter from the superintendent saying that they want to cut teachers' pay 12% and give us furlough days and all that stuff. you know, we have a union and stuff. And but, you know, I come here and I find that we're all in this together and that we're all looking for this. I get my power greater than myself from these meetings. I mean, I'm not a practicing Jew. I was kind of born Jew. This is funny. Richie suggested I get down on my knees and pray. And I said, Richie, you know, I was born Jewish. And he said, since when have you ever been a practicing Jew? Get down on your knees. So the more willing I am to follow contrary action and suggestions that are given to me, the better I feel. My sponsor says, you know, I have no idea whether when I pray, the prayer doesn't go anywhere outside of this room. You can't prove God. You can't prove the existence. But I know one thing. I feel better when I do it. So I like to feel good. The program is full of all kinds of practical experience for me, and I'm glad to share it. And I don't know. I ask me questions. Yes, Heather. What do I do the first thing in the morning? First thing in the morning, I pee. That is a wonderful feeling. I have like books in my nightstand, and I get down on my knees. Thank you, Rishi, and I say my prayers. I get a call at 5:30 in the morning, and we talk about food and we talk a little bit about spirituality, and I read those books and I say say my prayers, the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer. I kind of ask God for faith and trust, because sometimes in the morning I get scared, you know, and you never know, you know, I teach 5 classes a day, 25 classes, different schools and stuff, and kids are very extemporaneous, shall we say. And so I ask my higher power, please give me faith and trust in you today, and give me some good orderly direction, let me know what the next step is to take, and let me have the desire to want to do your will, because I'll tell you the truth, I don't necessarily have the desire to please God all the time. I'd rather, you know, eat pizza and watch late night TV. So I ask for the desire. Another thing over my sponsor's office, he's got this thing, a guy went in a cave and he meditated for years and he came out with this saying, and the thing is Thomas Merton, it's not away, but it resonates with me, and it says, I don't have any idea whether I'm following your will or not. It says, but I know that the desire to please you does in fact please you, and I hope that I have that desire in everything I do. And I remember that, and I ask for that desire, because when I'm doing the right thing, God seems to be there for me. And Paul used to say the right thing is to act out of love. Well, it's hard for a self-centered person to act out of love, you know. But we try. I try. Yes.
How do you work this program? How do you work this program in your relationship with your wife, and how has it changed your relationship?
Well, how do I work this relationship the program in relationship with my wife, and how has it changed the relationship with my wife? And those of you who have been divorced and get married again. You still have to deal with the same, I have to deal with the same defects. So all the stuff that I carried with me in my first marriage, I brought to the second marriage. And I think the hardest thing for me to do, I'll give you an example this morning. Christine, my wife, was kind enough to make breakfast and lunch for me. I went to an all-day class today at the Skirball Center. And I was so grateful. I said, oh, thank you so much, Christine. And I looked in the lunch and she didn't pack my favorite fiber crackers. And I said, where are the crackers? And she said, I said, you forgot the crackers? And I was absolutely livid. And she said, what's the matter with you? And I said, they'll know at my OA meeting tonight. They'll understand. And she says, well, so what? You know, that doesn't... And I apologized, and you know. But boy, oh boy. I mean, she's the first person that I go off on when I don't get my way or when I get scared. And it doesn't matter whether I have kids around. We got three kids. I got a 17-year-old, a 13-year-old, a 10-year-old. You know, I'm ashamed to say this, and I'm better now than I have been. But, you know, I've been, you know, such rage that, you know, my kids cry. I've been crying, you know. And, you know, and I apologize. And the worst thing, if you have kids, I have kids, is you don't want to pass the character, I don't want to pass the character defects onto my kids. Sometimes I feel like I do that. So, anyway, I'm really rambling. It's changed because I know how to make amends. I'm learning how to keep my mouth shut and to call you guys when I'm livid at Christine and even when I'm righteously angry. You know, my sponsor said, oh, you're right. So you want to be happy or you want to be right? And I said, well, that's the same thing. How can you be happy without being right? So yeah, it's just keeping my eyes off Christine and just, you know, working my own program. And I have the excuse that, you know, well, Chris doesn't have a program. She's not in OA and she doesn't have a sponsor. And how come I have to do it and she doesn't have to? All this self-righteous craziness. But I'm amazed and blessed that, number one, I'm self-supporting now. It feels good. We're not making a lot of money. Chris is off of work. But that's a miracle. I mean, I didn't work till I was 43 years old. I got three kids. One's in high school, going to go to college. One's in junior high. One's in elementary. We're all over the place with the sports and everything. I'm a responsible parent. I'm a responsible husband. I love my wife, you know. So that is a big change. Gary.
Spirituality in terms of, was there something when you were growing up or not? We share the same, you know, religious background and ethnic background.
Okay, so was there any spirituality? How has my relationship with God, I'm repeating it, and spirituality changed over time? I was a scared little kid. And, you know, rightfully so, righteously so. My mom's schizophrenic, died in Camarillo when she was in her early 40s, keeled over from a heart attack. My dad died of cirrhosis of the liver. His dad died of cirrhosis. My uncle decided to come out of the closet when he was 30 years old in the early 60s. It was not fashionable to do so. He tried to commit suicide when the family ostracized him. And then a week later, he succeeded and he overdosed. So, yeah. I was a little bit scared, and I hear people in these rooms, compulsive overeaters, that had Father Knows Best existences and were as scared as I was. Through the inventory process, and lately I've been thinking about when I was a little kid, times that made me feel warm. Crap was happening all around me, but, you know, my grandmother raised me. She was a great cook. you know, I never wanted for clothing or food. I had an aunt, Tilly, may she rest in peace, that took me in. And I remember on Hanukkah, she gave me all kinds of presents. And my uncle Danny, who committed suicide, was very loving, you know, to me. And my father, when he was around, when he wasn't in the hospital, was a beautiful, sensitive role model to me. My mother, when she was lucid, you know, was a concert pianist. Had a scholarship to Juilliard before this mental stuff happened. So all, you know, the good and the bad, how do I choose to see it? You know, inventory and program helps me to see the good in my life. There's a saying that says, extract the good out of every situation and watch that which is unpleasant fade away. So I try to remember that consciously. And in the present and also in my memories of the past. Because there's a lot of good memories in the past. And I tend to forget about them and just latch on to the drama and the tragedy. So, thank you for the question. Does that answer? We'll talk later if you... Yeah. Yes?
Thank you. You talked a little bit about trust.
Well, Paul used to say that any defect that would kick his butt, he'd pray, I want to say, get on my knees, say, you know, God, I was really angry to Christine. I'm trying to think of something specific. This couldn't hurt for me to do tonight. Really angry and acted inappropriately this morning to my wife. I am going to be with my family tomorrow. I feel a little impatience and fear this evening. Can you take my impatience and fear away and my anger towards Christine? Can you please help me with that? And I swear, Paul used to say this too, never has the character defect been totally removed, but it's there so that you can be comfortable with it and that you don't have to destroy your relationship with it. Christine and I talk finances. Our goal is once a week to do that. We've learned to sit down and to tell each other we love each other, whether we mean it or, in my case, whether I mean it or not, you know, to act better than you feel. And then I'll grab Chris's hand. I'm sure she thinks I'm crazy. And I'll say, God, keep me from being angry at Christine. Make me know that we're on the same team, that Chris isn't the enemy. I don't know about you guys, but if you're in intimate relationships, your most loved people have become the enemy, you know. And so I talk to God that way a lot. And I swear that he responds, or she, or whatever, if you want to call your higher power. So that's what comes to mind. Wendy.
I'm wondering about your sponsoring. Do you sponsor a lot of people, or people?
Yeah. I have two sponsors. You know, one in both programs, and one in the other program, you ask him how many people he sponsors. He sponsors a lot of people. He says, one too few. I sponsor one too few. And then you ask Richie how many sponsors. He looks at me and he says, one too many. Richie's getting a lot of juice on this tape, so I have to send it to him. But I think I kind of want to err on my other sponsor. I would like to think, you know, one too few. Because it helps me. It helps me a lot. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't, but I don't refuse.
Hi.
Andrea.
Hi. Have you ever had an ending during life? And if so, how do you deal
with that? Envy during my abstinent life. Envy of other people?
Yeah.
As in comparing?
Yeah.
As in comparing? Oh, that too. Being too hard on myself and envy, they kind of go hand in hand. Today, at the Skirball music class, I'm bored. I have to concentrate to really get new. It's not fun for me anymore. We have to get in a group and we have to compose a song with lyrics. And I would much rather work by myself and isolate, and because I know better than anybody else. And I'm giving out ideas, and most of the group likes the ideas, but this one lady wants to change words of my song. And I didn't necessarily envy her, but I resented her. And after about a half hour of this process, I prayed and everything, and it was a collaboration. And then I started feeling less than, you know, because it seemed like the class went on forever, and everybody was younger than me. You know, I was the oldest guy there. And then the teacher was real young and vibrant, and she started to teach her part of the lesson, and I thought, I can do better than that. She's probably making more money than I am. She's younger than I can do better than that. And then I said, well, no, I'm scared. If I could, I mean, you know, in the hedge, and meh. And, you know, Andrea, I was a basket case. To tell you the truth, before this meeting, you know, I said, I have to share experience, strength, and hope. I'm exhausted. I sat in this thing with my head going on. And anyway, so I said a prayer. I went to the park and ran. And that calmed me down. And here we are together. Thank you for letting me share.